ESP, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that does love an election, if only so we can poke fun. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, is Dr. Anirban Mahanty. G'day, Doc.
G'day, Captain.
How are you, mate?
I'm good. What's happened to your voice?
Mate, I feel like a Shetland pony at the moment.
And why is that?
I'm a little horse.
And why are you a horse?
I don't know, but I'm hoping that I can battle through, mate, so if our listeners can bear with us. If this doesn't work out, I'm going to do late night radio. I'm going to be the new love god. With husky voice, I reckon I can almost pull that off. What do you reckon?
That's a powerful voice.
It's not what I would have chosen.
Yeah, we'll have to ask Will whether he's going to give you a job or not.
But. Now, mate, we've got a big podcast to get through this morning. We should start off, though, with some sad news. Former Labor PM Bob Hawke passed away yesterday. We were recording this on Friday morning. I've got to say, for me, Bob Hawke was kind of my first experience of kind of politics. Right? As I was getting older as a kid, I can remember Bob Hawke. I remember the America's Cup is what I remember. And the old man waking me up towards the seventh and final race, America's Cup. Australia 2 takes it. We finally win the America's Cup. And, of course, the very famous Bob Hawke, the jacket, the black and white newspaper jacket. And then the comment that any boss who sacks a worker today is a bum. And I thought, that's pretty much Bob Hawke in a nutshell, right? It's the Larry jacket, it's the outlandish comments, and it's the charisma that really endeared him to, he had at one point a 70% approval rating, which you think about these days, even people's own sides, right? If you're amongst their own team, they don't get 70% approval rating. Hawke was one out of the box, the longest serving Labor Prime Minister, we should note, won three or four elections, I think. So we do want to pay our respects and recognise and remember Bob Hawke. He was certainly one of a kind and the sort of guy that we don't see very much these days in politics.
It's very difficult to actually find a Prime Minister who is liked by both sides.
That's the thing.
That's pretty unique.
But even amongst their own side these days, you can't, between the Morrisons and Turnbulls and Duttons on one side and the Shortens and Albanese's and Plibersek's on the other, it's kind of the old days too when there was a bit more colour in politics, right? Before the kind of machine men took over, all that kind of stuff. Interesting comment. I was watching the Today Show this morning and as I was getting ready, and the comment was made, I can't remember who it was, that when the Australian dollar was floated back in 1983, to bring it back to an economics angle, Bob Hawke wasn't at the RBA, he wasn't at the ASX, he was at a race meeting in Adelaide, apparently. So I figure that's, sign of the times, right? Before the 24-hour news cycle, before all that kind of stuff. And we should say, again, I really don't want to get political. You don't want to get political. But I do want to recognise some of the changes that were made by the Labor Party and, frankly, in large part supported by the Liberals. So this is not a party partisan comment. But to the extent that, the floating of the dollar, the deregulation of the wages system, the award system for those who studied high school economics back in the day, bringing down of tariffs, there was a very, very big reform agenda pursued by the Labor Party. And as I said, supported in large part by the Libs. So this is not about being party political. But one of those things that really, is just to a large degree, those changes and some made by subsequent governments have set us up for such a long run of unbridled success, 28 years and counting of a recession-free economy, in no small part due to the work of Hawke, Keating and those that followed. So, vale Bob. Mate, let's get on with the rest of the podcast then. We've got a big docket to get through. We'll start with some macro. Mm-hmm. You love a bit of macro because we're going to talk about house prices. And I know
a little bit.
I know you'll hate that. We're going to talk a little bit of confession season. Mm-hmm. It hasn't been a great week on the market for some. Although on the other side, we're also going to talk about a company that's finally delivered some profitability, delivering on the hopes of many. So let's get into it.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Now, mate, the big macro, the big news number, let me give you a number, and do you tell me what it is? 5.2. What am I talking about and why does it matter?
That's the unemployment rate.
It is the Australian unemployment rate, and it was up to 0.2%, 20 basis points, depending on your language. It was not the direction that people had hoped it would go.
Yeah, so it's, okay. So it was 5% before. Yes. It's 5.2 now.
Yes.
It's not a terrible number. It's not you can say it's, it has worse, it's become worse by 20 basis points, so 0.25%. It's not, I think it's not the end of the world in any way, right? I mean, but I think there were a couple of interesting things in that number, which I thought was worth pointing out. It seems like a lot more people want more work.
Yes.
And so that's basically, utilization, I guess, of the workforce. Mm-hmm. That is below what you know, I guess people want it to be. I think that's I think problematic to some extent, because it seems to suggest that, you know, people want you know, work, and they want to be gainfully employed, but they're not. Women are large participants in the market, which is a good thing.
Which is
you know, you want, you know, that's 50% of the population. You want them to be contributing to the to the economy.
Exactly.
So, in some sense, I think this is a soft number, which I think is going to increase the. I guess the Clarion calls for a rate cut.
Yeah.
Because if the unemployment rate increases, then I guess that is negative pressure on inflation, and you know, our RBA governor would be keen to keep inflation in that, or trying to get inflation to the band. It's not in that band. Although I have to say, I mean, you know, that's a number that people have been trying to, you know, it's in many ways an artificial number, right? You know, let's keep it between this and that.
Inflation between 2% and 3% is the official Australian benchmark or target rate. Hasn't been there for a long, long time. The RBA yet hasn't seen fit to cut. So I want to unpack a little bit what you talked about just before. So you talked about the workforce participation rate, which is what the boffins call the number of people looking for jobs. And it's one of those weird things where the unemployment rate isn't actually the number of Australians unemployed compared to the total number of Australians. We compare it to what's known as the labour force or the workforce. And that's defined by the number of people actually with a job plus the number of people looking for a job. So if you're not looking for a job, if you're on the Bahamas somewhere, you're a self-made squillionaire, you're not looking for a job, maybe not the Bahamas because then you wouldn't be in Australia, maybe Bribie Island, let's go with that. You know, at some level, you're not counted in the labour force for that purpose, right? Mm-hmm. What they're trying to count is how many people want a job, how many people can get a job, and then how many are left over.
Yeah.
So to the extent that more people last month said, hey, I'm actually going to start looking now, that, ironically, and there were twice as many jobs created as were expected. So on one hand, you say, well, hang on, more jobs created than expected. How did the rate go up? Now, in large part, expectations are different to reality, but also the difference is a whole lot more people saying, no, actually, I want a job now. Now, that's either great because more people want to get the workforce, or it's bad because some households are feeling a bit
pressure.
Like cost of living pressure. And they say, well, geez, I guess we better go back to work or get, you know, get back to the labor force. So either way, It's not as negative as it might on the headline seem, because it's not like more people are out of work. It's not like more people lost their jobs last month. Mm-hmm. It's just that more people wanted one than could get one relative to the previous month, and that drove things higher. Let's go then to the inflation rate, mate, because you mentioned that. That's a really good one. Let's nerd out for just 30 seconds, maybe a minute, because I like to nerd out. The target range of 2-3%, as you said, there was a fantastic Planet Money podcast episode maybe 12 months ago, and there's no science behind the target rate. There's no kind of modeling done. It was one of those things where they kind of said, well, look, too little inflation is bad, too much inflation is bad, so let's pick a bigger number. And in the US, I think they pick exactly 2% from memory. The RBA here says 2-3% to give themselves a range. And the idea there is that deflation or stagflation or low inflation is really bad for an economy because people put off their purchases. Very high inflation, as we all well know, is terrible for an economy because you can't spend your money fast enough. They just prices go up and up and up and up and up. And we've seen cases of Zimbabwe that had 1,000,000% inflation at one point, which is obviously crazy. So 2-3% is the official band. I reckon that in the fullness of time, we will actually see that band revised down more than the number actually go up. I think there's so many macro pressures pushing on the inflation rate. Predominantly, as the economists like to phrase it, we are importing deflation. So the products we're buying from overseas are cheaper because there's more scale. It's being made by people, frankly, on cheaper wages. So every time you replace a locally made, let's pick car, with an internationally made car, generally speaking, the cost of that car is cheaper. Same for TV, same for sewing machines, same for, you know, insert here. And that move is having an effect of pushing down prices, right? That year on year on year, the prices, other than maybe petrol and electricity, prices are just being pushed down further and further. And so it's harder, ironically, to get inflation because of that the deflation that's being imported from overseas.
Yeah, I agree. Completely agree.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, I'm very hesitant to bring this one up because...
What is it?
Well, you're going to enjoy it way too much. And as much as I love you, there are limits to how much joy I want to see you have on a Friday morning. Mate, so the headline is 1 in 25 home loans could be underwater.
That's from Macquarie.
That was from Macquarie. Mm-hmm. So underwater being... effectively that the houses are now worth less than the loan value. So you bought a house for $1 million, that's what you bought it for. Your mortgage is for $1 million and the house is worth $950,000. You literally owe more than the house is worth. 1 in 25 doesn't seem like a big number. It's 4%. So on one hand, you say, well, that's pretty small. On the other hand, we know that as with economies, the difference between a plus one and a minus one is a massive deal, right? Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about very, very large numbers, and frankly, economies that rely on momentum and kind of confidence, it doesn't take too much to upset the apple cart. And if Macquarie's right, what are the impacts for house prices?
Well, I mean, the other thing is that banks by default are leveraged businesses, right?
Right.
One is to 10 leverage.
Exactly.
So 1% movement actually is a big deal.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah, so 1%, you know, if there's a 1% default, it could actually wipe out a lot of profits for the banks, right?
Yep.
So I think it's important. Actually, Macquarie, you know, I read this, I don't have access to a report, so I read it's on the Fin. One of the interesting things is that it looks like they're extrapolating the numbers based on a few things. So different banks in their quarterly updates provide different data.
Yes.
Right. So the data they're basing this off is, you know, actually ANZ's number, they said, is around close to 5% or a little less than 5% if you actually include the offset, which I think you should. Like,
yes,
if there's money in the offset, then you should include it.
Agreed.
That's not really debt. And then they're saying 5%. Which is closer to this 4% number. You know, for CBA, that number is somewhere around, I think, 3%. And for NAB and Westpac, it's around 1% and 1.5%.
Okay.
But apparently, there's a different way in which CBN NAB and Westpac actually report these numbers or compute these numbers. So, I mean, it's the, again, we know that the house prices have fallen, right? And they've actually fallen a bit more since the last report.
Yep.
So if there is negative equity, that negative equity has actually become more negative now, or maybe it has stabilized a bit. So it's not a concern if we assume that, you know, if we assume that, you know, most of the people in the market or with home loans, actually, or loans, are people who are going to live there.
Mm-hmm.
Or are people who are investors who have rented it out to someone and are happy to get the rent and actually pay for it.
Yeah.
As long as people are paying for it, it's not really a big deal, right? I think the problem is when people can't pay for it, or I think feel that it's going to go further down and therefore now is my time to exit, then I think it can cause the spiral where actually it can continue going down.
So are you worried about lower house prices, or are you worried about the broader economic effect, or both? How are you thinking about this?
Well, I think I think both, right? I mean, if there's more selling, it has an impact on, you know, if there are defaults, for example, it causes defaults, then I think it's bad for that section of the people who are actually defaulting. So that's one. So they're going to spend less.
Yep.
It's also psychologically too, right? If people see that they're in negative equity, they're likely to spend less, which has then flow-on effects on the economy, right? So, this is a hard problem to solve because, I mean, what do you do? Is the solution to this to actually jack up the prices of houses?
Right.
and then continue the cycle. Then the cycle is going to burst at some point again. that's a simplistic, let's just forget about it. Let's try to, you know, push the prices up so that everybody's in positive equity. That's one option. But I think, you know, some sort of engineering is slow and steady sort of housing market price. Some stabilization, maybe slowly decreasing. And that's, I think, what has happened so far is probably the appropriate thing to do. So, I mean, maybe we're in the right direction. As long as things don't get out of hand, it shouldn't have this compound, you know, it's like a double whammy of people spending less because they feel that way. And then a section of people defaulting because they can't keep up.
Mm.
Right. So, am I too worried? Not really. I'll add this. In the last quarter report for ANZ, there was a good uptick in the loans that are in the area. So these are loans that have not been paid in 90 days.
When you say a good uptick, you mean a bad uptick?
I mean an uptick in the bad number.
I know.
And I think this was consistent across another bank. I forgot the name of that other bank.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's...
Yeah, that's definitely right.
Yeah, so maybe there's that happening already. So, yeah, I mean... Yeah, again, not out of the ordinary.
Yeah, and that's the watch out, right? So if we skate through that a broader economic impact, then there's no necessarily direct impact or cost or problem with having negative equity. makes you feel a bit ordinary if you're the homeowner. Now, you can't get away from without the loan anyway, so you've got to do something. You're in the hole regardless. Maybe ironically, that makes people hold on to their houses, and maybe they don't sell them and try and make back the money. We know that anchoring as a psychological bias is a big one. People don't want to, you know, crystallize a loss. By the same token, as you rightly point out, if they can't meet those repayments, that's problematic. And of course, then for those that are investment properties, a whole different question, a whole different story around the cash flow you're getting and the confidence people feel in whether or not and how long it will take for that price to recover.
I mean, it's complicated because, I mean, you know, there are like investors who might be from overseas who might think, oh, well, you know, this Aussie dollar and these houses are no longer holding value.
What
do I do? Should I basically just sell and get out of the hell, you know, get the hell out of here and go somewhere else, right? You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, I mean, there's a whole slew of issues. I mean, just the fact that, you know, the homes are expensive or the fact that people have a lot of loan in itself is not a problem.
Like places like
Denmark where people actually never finish paying off their debt.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they go their entire life and they still owe something to the bank.
Right. And or in Germany where people effectively rent for their entire lives. Home ownership is really quite low as an owner-occupier.
Right. So, I mean, it's a different model.
Yeah.
And it works.
I don't know if it'll work here, but we'll see.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, let's get away from the macro for a minute because that's kind of, I do find it fascinating, but it can get very, very nerdy and very, very theoretical. So let's go to some real numbers, and I will start, unfortunately. Well, we've got a good, we've got a bad, and we've got an ugly. So I'm going to do a reverse order. I'll keep the good up our sleeve just to put the highlight at the end. Mate, the ugliest one based on at least share price this week was a sense that, let's take a half step back. We saw the beginning of what we like to call confession season. Mm. Now, again,
you have to explain what that means.
Man, don't finance people love jargon, and it's just drives me nuts. Anyway, so let's go even a step further back. Earnings season is the kind of term given to that time or those two times of the year when companies report their earnings on the ASX. So if you're a listed company, you have to report your earnings twice a year. Some do it quarterly for different reasons, but let's go with the mainstream. We've got to report your earnings twice a year, normally within 2 months at the end of the financial year or the financial half. So effectively that means that most years in both February and August, companies will come to the ASX and say, hey, here's the required documentation. Here's our profit and loss. Here's our balance sheet, cash flow. Here's our commentary. Here are all the notes of the accounts. This is the one chance we get twice a year to look under the bonnet and really see what's going on with these companies in black and white numbers. So that's earnings season.
And that's typically, February
and August?
February and August,
yes.
Yeah, okay.
Companies then are obliged to, I might get you around on continuous disclosure in a minute. We'll see how we go for time. Companies are required to adhere to a regime called continuous disclosure. And that is if a company knows something that is material, it is obliged to disclose that to the ASX. The idea there, and again, you have a different view, which we might tease out in a minute. The idea, at least behind the theory behind it, is that you don't want any non-public information to be around. So if I know something, you don't know it, then I may be able to trade on that information. The general idea is that you release the information as soon as you know it, so everybody knows and the market is fully informed. That leads to then what we call confession season. And so we're now in mid-May. The financial year ends about 6 weeks' time. And companies are starting to look at their results and all their sales numbers, their profit numbers, saying, you know what, for all of our best hopes, for all of our best dreams, we hoped things would get better. We kind of, you know, we hope. We're now so close to the end of the financial year, we're kind of realizing that no matter what we do, we can't possibly deliver the sort of guidance we've previously given. So companies will say to the market semi-regularly, here's what I think I'm going to do for the year. That puts them on the hook to then update that guidance if and when that's required. And confession season is the result when companies come out. Very rarely are confessions positive. It tends to be those companies that are not going to deliver what they said they're going to deliver. And so we saw a couple this week. But the first is a company that you and I have both been a little bit close to. We've certainly had it in some of our services, The Motley Fool, unfortunately. That company is Experience Co., which frankly is a terrible name and should have been my first giveaway. Was known as Skydive the Beach, which at least is does what it says on the tin. This is a, what do they call them? Adventure sports, adventure tourism? What do they call themselves these days? What's the category?
The adrenaline pumping adventure.
There you go.
So adventure tourism.
Think jet boating, think skydiving at beaches, funnily enough.
Other Great bits Barrier Reef and stuff like that.
There you go. In theory, great business, right? Lots of tourism, lots of money being spent. More and more people coming to Australia from around the world. They've got some business in New Zealand as well. Ordinarily, you think that should be a great business.
That's what we thought.
Not this week.
It's been in this in the reverse for I think some time. So one of the things they've said in the past is weather. So Queensland weather, I mean, we get it. Queensland weather can be erratic.
Yes.
We all know they can have flood, they cyclone, can have cyclone, yep. They can have more rain, less rain, all sorts of things.
Yep.
And these can have impact on various activities that you do.
Right. Well, you can't exactly, if you're in Australia for a week and a half from the US, you can't exactly wait 3 weeks for the weather to clear, right?
Exactly.
You can either skydive or you can't.
You can't. So, I mean, that's a real headwind. I think what happened with this business is the business was basically, as you said, Skydive the Beach, which was basically a skydiving business. They went and acquired a bunch of other businesses in mostly northern Queensland to do, whitewater rafting, going to the Great Barrier Reef, having a, pontoon there so that people can, dive into the water and things like that.
Yep.
That was supposed to, diversify the business, actually de-risk the business to some extent from a weather point of view. Actually, that's done exactly the opposite in the time since, because, it's actually increased weather dependencies for the business. So that's part of the, I think that's part of the problem. Mm. I think the other problem is that, when you buy businesses one-off, you do increase your revenue and your earnings one-off, right?
Yep.
But then we have to fundamentally think about the fact that, we've got a business, how many people are going to go to the Great Barrier Reef on that one ship, right? You know what I mean, right?
Yep.
I mean, there can only so many people you can stuff there. After that, you've got, you've got a problem.
Yep.
So I think growth is hard. And then at the same time, if there is a decline in tourism, which is what the company is actually saying, that the number of flights coming into Cairns has actually gone down.
That's interesting.
Now, that's an interesting statistics, worth actually digging into.
Yeah.
I find that number a bit surprising. I mean, Gold Coast and Queensland in general, it's a pretty hot and happening place. And we are known as, along with New Zealand, to be one of the good places to come for adventure tourism. So why is the tourism numbers down? Maybe maybe these things have their own cycles, and maybe we should be attractive now. Our dollar is even is lower.
I'm really surprised, right? Because Sydney Airport has been doing spectacular business with inbound tourism. Cairns Airport doesn't release its numbers, at least not that I've seen. Sydney Airport, because the listed company, has to release those numbers. And international tourism has been just doing spectacularly well for years now. I'm flabbergasted that the Cairns numbers are down.
Yeah, so I mean, part of the problem might be that, it could be an infrastructure related issue too, right? I mean, you can't probably land an A380, for example, in Gold Coast, in Gold Coast Airport. And we have been to Gold Coast Airport,
right?
You know, we have a headquarters there, our Australian headquarters there. And, that airport is basically like a bus terminal with a runway attached to it, right?
Indeed.
I'm being pretty generous when I say that. So I think there is also probably caps and limits in what you can do until the infrastructure, I think, substantially upgrades. So maybe that's part of the problem.
Still down is different. Anyway.
Yeah, but I mean,
so in theory, that's temporary, though. I mean, if you're an experienced co-shareholder, you're looking at it and saying, well, that's not, I mean, it's crappy, but in theory, that's temporary, or is there something bigger at play?
Well, so a couple of things. So they have also gone through a management change, right? So part of, I think, the problem was that I think they maybe have paid too much to acquire these bunch of different things.
Okay.
There might be a write-down, which is non-cash, but, there might be a write-down basically saying, well, we paid too much. That's one possibility.
Yeah, makes sense.
With the new management team now in place, and as you said, it's still a profitable company, at least on an operating basis. It's still making money. And as you said, that it is something that, we think there should be demand for it. So, I mean, if it's a question of properly managing it, and if you take a longer term view, which we take here at The Motley Fool, then, it looks like the prices are kind of depressed, and, we still have it as a hold, actually, in extreme opportunities.
Yep.
So it's not a buy. We haven't, largely because there's a lot of, uncertainty. Mm. But, we wouldn't sell it. We haven't sold it largely because we think, again, it's a profitable company in an area which should do well.
That's the thing. It surprised me it's not doing better.
It's the missed opportunities, I think, And often, execution is actually a big part of a lot of these things, right?
Yeah.
So we're looking to that execution angle. And the other thing, the final thing I'll point out, and I know that I'm taking too much time here. The final thing I'll point out is often when you have a new CEO or a new management team, there is this tendency, okay, let's throw everything bad that we have out there. Give the new guy a clean slate. It's called, throw the kitchen sink.
Yes, clearing the decks.
Clearing
as they like to
the
say.
Decks. Yep. And then maybe give them a clear head start,
yeah,
sort of thing. Yeah. So maybe that's, you know, that's what's happening here. And that's another interpretation. But yeah, I mean, disappointing is the word I would use.
All right, so that's experience code. EXP is the code for those playing along at home. Mate, speaking of clearing the decks and speaking of disappointing, most of our listeners probably, I don't know how many listeners we have that use skincare products. I hazard a guess, not a large proportion, but you never know.
You use those shampoos.
I don't.
That's why I'm asking.
That's very unkind. I once had hair, and at that point, I still didn't use their shampoos, but I may have these days if I had hair.
So you're responsible.
It's all your fault. The balding of Australia is costing us. Thank you for that low blow. But this is probably
You look good. How's that?
You're trying hard. I appreciate it. Okay. Too little, too late, but thank you. I look better than I sound, which is unusual and not saying much. Sukin brand, people, S-U-K-I-N, some of our listeners may have seen around the place. Maybe it's on your shelf at home. Maybe you've seen it at the shop. A brand, the company, BWX is the name of the business, by the way, calls Mastige, which is a combination of mass and prestige, which, you know, I don't know. I'm never sure whether that's a great strategy because you're covering a lot of people, or whether that lack of kind of specialization actually means you're jack of all trades, a master of none. But we'll leave that aside, other than maybe this was part of the problem. So BWX was the absolute high flyer of 2016, 17.
Yeah.
It went through the roof, hit $6. I think
$8 something. There you go.
Shares were on a tear. This business was doing fantastic, fantastic business. Sukin was growing at, I want to say, 40%.
40%, yeah.
Growing, going
internationally, 100% plus.
Going to Asia. They then went and bought some other business in the US to give themselves a beachhead in the States to really take the Sukin brand and do great things with it, and also sell those brands in Australia and other places around the world. This was a business going places. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, the CEO decides he wants to try and take over the company, mm-hmm. launches a takeover bid in combination with private equity. Shareholders say no. The CEO resigns. Private equity walks away. Fast forward, geez, it's almost 12 months now, is it?
Mm.
And the share price is languishing at about $1.50, $1.60, mm. something like that.
Yeah.
That's been a hell of a fall from grace, mate. And the reason for the most recent fall, it fell about 15% earlier this week, was that basically the Sukin brand, the business that was supposed to be the great white hope, the great, you know, brand new business that was going to deliver wonderful things, has just fallen effectively dead flat. They can't buy growth for love nor money. In fact, they're not buying growth. And part of the reason they explained was that they're not going to pursue unprofitable promotions. They also said in passing that there was a lot of stock in the trade. I can't remember exactly what phrase they used to describe that. Mm. Euphemistically, what they are referring to is the fact that in the past, the company did a lot of promotions, sold a lot of stock to a whole lot of retailers, and those retailers probably still have most of that stock on the shelves. It's very hard to sell more stock into a guy that's already got some on the shelf, and that's hurt them. So to some degree, last year's success, whether that's a real success or maybe even a manufactured success because they incentivized retailers to buy more stock than they needed, that's come back to bite them in 2019.
Yeah. So I'll own up here. You know, it was a company that, you know, I really liked, and I pushed it actually at Share Advisors on my fault. on that company. And, you know, when we looked at the company, for all those things that you mentioned, you know, it had great execution at that time, you know, firing on all cylinders. I think a couple of things. The management distraction did not help. And there's a backstory there that the management said that, you know, their story was that we're going to continue acquiring stuff and to grow via acquisitions, you know, which is a favorite thing actually on the ASX. It's one of the, you know, the hot topics all the time. You know, we want to just acquire because we can raise capital. And then it looked like some significant shareholders basically put pressure saying, no, we want profits and you want you to actually grow organically. And that caused this, you know, okay, we're going to try to bid. And then, you know, Bain Capital, who was the private equity, actually walked out of the deal. But, okay, so, you know, now that we have, you know, some benefit of hindsight, but I would say what happened here is, or this is my interpretation of the story, is Sukin was growing really fast because at that time it was acquiring new channels for distribution, right? So, you know, you think about, you know, you start with Chemist Warehouse, maybe you get a shelf, then you maybe get two shelves, right? Then you know, expand to Coles and maybe to Woolies and so on and so forth. So that gives you natural growth. Once you've exhausted the most of the useful channel, at that point, then it becomes harder to find, you know, you're going to grow back like 3-4%. So that's that.
Yep.
But it should have had a lot of opportunity internationally. And part of the story was that, you know, they acquired this thing called Mineral Fusion from private equity overseas in the US. And the idea was, well, you know, that's a, it's a beachhead in the sense of they have distribution. We're going to use the distribution to distribute Tsukin. Then we can bring that product over here. And
which is not a silly idea, at least in theory, right?
In theory, it's a great idea.
You've got to, you buy a sales team, you buy some relationships with retailers, you buy some distribution capability, you buy some market knowledge. You buy a business that, frankly, is already making money anyway.
Exactly.
So you're kind of getting all that stuff for free in theory, as long as you do it well.
Exactly. And I think that is where I think the boat actually, you know, got rocked. Because I think it was from private equity, and I think they lost people there, and they lost key people. Or maybe those key people actually were looking to exit, and these guys did not have the right replacements or the right relationships. Or maybe there weren't right relationships in the first place.
Yeah.
Right. With the retailers there. And I think that, combined with the loss of CEO, basically derailed the international strategy.
Yeah, okay.
Right. And I think that has basically, you know, taken its toll on the company. And, you know, that's why where we are today. You know, I still believe that, the brand had promise. I think, you know, the Clean Green Australia had promise. We still use their products. Their products are actually pretty good.
That's what I find frustrating about both Experience Co. and Tsukin is these are businesses and brands that, by rights, should be successful.
Yeah.
To actually not be successful to some degree is, I don't cast blame too recklessly, but ordinarily you'd think you'd have to try pretty hard to screw these things up.
Yeah, this could be a case of just basically being over aggressive and trying to chew more than you can bite and eat, and I think that's basically what has happened. And and being then CEO-less, basically being, I call it, headless chick chicken is a problem. You know, now they've got a new CEO, so maybe things will, rectify. Yeah, so, I mean, it's not been a pleasing experience. And again, you know, as you said, in on paper and given those results at that time, it did look like, this thing is going to go places, but it did not.
Very disappointing. I think your point is interesting about Tsukin, mate. And that so it's a hold for us at Share Advisor still. And as much as you were happy to accept responsibility, it's my fault. I get to make the final calls, good or bad. So I'll wear that one. The thing is that the promise was real, right? It wasn't a hard pitch to make to say Tsukin is growing at a rate of knots. What we may have done in hindsight is maybe over egged the expectation of long term growth because, as you say, once you got that shelf space, then you're kind of going to fall back to relatively GDP-ish type growth just because you're already everywhere, right? So the whole idea, if you've got a new product, you have it in one shop, then two shops, then 10 shops, then 100 shops, you're going to grow really fast. By the time it's in every supermarket in the country, well, unless you can convince people to change brands, which will happen, and the category will grow a decent rate and all that kind of stuff. But the long-term growth, at least in Australia, in a mature market, is much, much lower than we're used to. Maybe we maybe over-egged that. The international could have been much bigger and better, frankly, also, in a different parallel universe. The UK is flying and everything's wonderful and it's a good business to have and be in. I don't know whether that's necessarily a good enough excuse, but it's a tough one. We've got on hold for the reasons you talk about. I think Tsukin is still a really good brand. There's no evidence that consumers are... it's one of those things where, you know what, we probably paid too much in hindsight, but also if you strip away the ructions between stock going from the BWX warehouse to the retailer stores and just look at consumer sales, you'd still feel pretty good about the business. The fact that they created high expectations, we came off high levels of growth, they probably promised and expected things that maybe weren't reasonable. If you could buy the business, you still would have bought it 3 years ago. We probably would have paid a much lower price though, but it's not the business has necessarily gone badly in a branded kind of demand driven consumer pull through. It's just the whole stock in trade issue and the amount of promotions and that kind of stuff seems to have been the problem.
Yeah, if I may say one thing, I seeing the number of companies that actually can't manage acquisitions, I have become really wary of companies that actually use acquisition as a growth model.
And we should say that the numbers on that are ordinary too. The research actually backs that up. It's very, very rare. It's very, very rare. It's unlikely, statistically unlikely, that you'll make an acquisition work for a business if you're acquiring, particularly if it's a large one. Smaller ones tend to work better, but if you're making large acquisitions, there's a very high chance that'll go quite badly.
Yeah, I think maybe that's, I'll pin the blame on that.
Good deal. Mate, we're going to go to the good. So we had the ugly, we had the bad, and we are going out a bit of time. What I like about this conversation, by the way, is I think it's a useful one as we get towards earnings season. So in the next 6 weeks, we're going to have more confessions. We're going to then have July and August, which we'll see some earnings start to come through. And so it's a nice chance to kind of lay out some of this groundwork, some of the things that we're frankly learning ourselves and watching out for as we go forward. So the good here is a really fascinating story. It's one that I know you like a lot. I'm going to get you to hold some of the conversation till next week, because I've got some questions to ask you next week about around SaaS, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. But the company is Xero, and it jumped about 7% at the end, I think it was, during the week.
7 or 8%, or it was up like 10% at one time.
Oh, nice. Okay, maybe, okay, there you go. Maybe it's higher.
What's
a couple of percentage points, exactly, my friends?
Yeah.
So Xero is one, it was the kind of original, in air quotes, SaaS company, software as a service. It was the one, particularly in Australia, that defined the category, that kind of opened people's eyes to the potential of a business to build itself out at scale with a software product. So not necessarily like an Amazon was always scale for the sake of selling more products. That's a physical scale. The SaaS idea, the software as a service idea, is you build it once, sell it many times, but you then can redeploy a whole lot of cash in building the market. So you make sure you're first there, you get the biggest market share possible, and then you go and basically extract a whole lot of value from the category. Now, Xero has been promising that for 7 or 8 years, I want to say. Mm-hmm. 5 years ago, the share price was $40. A couple of years ago, it was $12.
Yep.
And now it's gone to a record all-time high.
Near 60-something.
It's finally made a profit.
Yeah.
At least in the second half.
It has made a profit. It's made a tiny profit in the second half.
Tiny, right? Let's be fair. But also, it's a meaningful benchmark, a meaningful milestone for them, because they haven't yet. And the whole investment thesis from us and other people had been based on, hey, just wait. The kind of the machinery is in place. The wheels are turning. They will get to the right result. You can't see the cake yet, but the mixture is looking good.
Yeah, that's right. And then, they're not going to make a lot of profit even going forward. They basically said, you know, we'll be free cash flow positive, but you'll basically stay around that number. As you said, you know, operating leverage, basically the ability to, you know, grow the top line but grow the bottom line faster than the top line is something that starts happening at scale at this type of business. Right. And you want to take this conversation to the next week, right?
Keep going. We'll talk about SaaS more broadly, but Xero in particular. So here's the basic idea. They'd said, look, we've got this great new system. They'd done a fantastic job of creating a, you know, before then, if you bought a product from Reckon or from Intuit or from MYOB, you'd buy the CD, you'd take it home, or you take it to the office, you put it in the computer, you upload the software, you type all your data in.
Yeah.
Then the next time there was a new version of the software updated, you'd get another CD in the mail, you'd buy another CD, every couple of years you'd update it. So everyone had different versions of MYOB, just to choose an example. They're all running different versions of it. The accountant had a different version. If you want to send your data to your accountant, you have to download a file, either email it to them or send them a USB stick or something.
Yeah.
That was the old one. That was still pretty good, right? That was a huge advantage on the old shoebox full of receipts. The Xero kind of said, look, this is accounting for everybody. So if you're a one-person, you know, chippy, subcontracting to somebody else, you can still run your accounts. It's simple. It's easy. It's online. Your accountant can jump in. They kind of brought accounting to, I won't say the masses, because frankly, you know, you and I don't use it as individuals. But you know, business-wise, it brought accounting to small and medium businesses in a way that had never been done before. And then they had a model which said, and by the way, when we do this well, we will be able to revolutionize an industry. And again, it was one of those businesses where in a parallel universe, it ran out of cash and died, right? And so we shouldn't say it was always a fait accompli, but there's a really interesting way to think about some of these businesses, which we will get into next week, which is basically the story of understanding what the future might look like, understanding the likelihood of them getting there, and actually being able to look through the financials.
Yeah.
You mentioned Xero, and I know you're not as much of an Amazon bull as I am, although I think we both own shares. You mentioned Xero and Amazon. I mentioned Amazon. The idea that Xero is kind of now profitable, going to maintain a small level of profit over time while it continues to grow, is reminiscent of the Amazon kind of journey as well, right? They lost money for a very, very long time. Then they kind of started to become a little bit profitable, and they've stayed about that level, saying, look, we'll show you we're actually making some cash, so, you know, things are less risky than it looks, but we're not going to make a lot of money because we still want to reinvest in growth. And that's still a very much a strong part, as you've already mentioned, of the Xero story.
That's absolutely right. I think, yeah, when you've got a lot of scaling options, like so they have dominant market share now. Like, so Xero's got dominant market share in Australia and New Zealand.
Right.
Then are rapidly trying to increase market share in the UK. And then, you know, the UK share is actually accelerating. Right. So if you think about other countries that are similar to, you know, Australia and New Zealand, you know, you could probably go to South Africa. You could go maybe to other parts of Europe, some parts of Asia.
Canada.
There's a lot of options, right? Yep. There's competition. So, the only place where they're, I think, struggling still is the US, where they've got strong competition from Intuit with their QuickBooks solution. But I mean, you know, if even if this is a duopoly or, you know, two companies, you know, making sure there's a lot of optionality here. But it gets even better, right? I mean, what gets better is that stage one is to take accounting and move the accounting job to your computer or your laptop or your iPad or whatever, right? Or your phone. Step two is to, you know, then get all these bank feeds that are coming in, right? So the bank feeds are coming in. Now banks or other providers or even Xero have actually got a lot of information about your business. Yep. That could be used to do other things, right? So other financial services can then be offered. So there's right. Then there are other tools that they offer, you know, roster management. You know, these are not offered by, but by other people. This is like a bit like an app ecosystem, right?
Okay.
So, you know, just like, you know, Apple would have an app ecosystem where, you know, its device becomes more useful because other people build tools for it. Well, Xero becomes more useful because other people now build tools, you know, whether it's roster management, payroll, you know, single touch payment, all those sort of things you can now do, right? Integrate that in, it becomes stickier and stickier. You take a small cut, just like Apple would do or Google Play would do. Yep. Take a little cut from those guys for the money that they are making.
Yep.
But in effect, you're actually a self-perpetuating sort of phenomenon, right? So those sort of things actually really help. And then
it's a really cool model if you get right. Right. So the killer app is still the accounting software. That's what people are signing up for in the first place. But when you can then solve their problems by incentivizing other people to create solutions, You provide those software programmers with a way to market, which is, hey, we've already got these customers using Xero. You can use our base to kind of sell your product on a customer end. They're saying, well, I'd like to have roster management, I'd like to have payroll, I'd like to have whatever else they offer. And if I want to do that, I can also put that in. That combination is a pretty nice kind of network effect in and of itself. But it's also that idea that they're almost a marketplace, right? They're bringing together the buyer and the seller in a way they couldn't have done otherwise.
Right. And the more buyers brings more sellers bring more buyers. And, you know, it can be actually a self-perpetuating sort of thing. And
that is the most beautiful network effect.
Basically beautiful network effect. So I think that's what they are, you know, and maybe this is just phase one, because you could do a lot of things again with the data the data they're seeing or the data that you're actually bringing in to do some artificial intelligence, learn more about your business and help with, for example, business loans are a good example. So I think, you know, you're still in early stages in that sense for a pretty big business, which is what, like $8 billion market capitalization.
That's big.
And so on. So, but, you know, I mean, still pretty early.
It's only just making money too.
It's making money.
There's a lot of hope left in the price.
Yeah, but, you know, the revenue is growing at 30%, right? Yeah. Top line growing at that speed. I mean, it's okay.
Which is pretty impressive, I have to say, for Xero. I didn't think it would be growing at that rate this far into its life. If it had succeeded in the US, that would have been a different story entirely. That was always a step change. But outside the US, I would have given you very, very long odds that if you asked me in 2013 and said, look, in 2019, what's the Xero's growth rate in its established markets? 30% is a phenomenal result.
Yeah, I think part of this is the ability to have cracked some of the international markets, which, you know, is interesting. I actually did not think that they would be able to crack the US because, and that I has agree. Played out exactly like that. Yeah. I had underestimated their ability to actually grow internationally, which they've, you know, the UK growth has actually been pretty phenomenal.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, you know, good execution, all sort of the right things that you look for in a business.
And another great win for Australasia. We're claiming Xero's ours, like Farlap and Russell Crowe and Pavlova. A wonderful Australian company.
We need to give our friends down across the ditch a little bit of credit here. And this is a Kiwi company founded in New Zealand. Although we did one thing, we stole it from their share market.
We did. They delisted from the NZX. That's got to hurt if you're a Kiwi, right? It's a Kiwi homegrown company now with $8 billion. And they say, yeah, look, it's been fun. We don't want to be here anymore.
That's brutal. Well, that's some of the advantage of being big brothers. You steal stuff.
We do love our Kiwi brothers and sisters. Hey, cuz.
Yeah.
All right. That does wrap us up from Motley Fool Money. But before we go, don't forget you can subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. And if you like what we're doing, please give us a 5-star rating on iTunes and tell your friends. We're sure they could do with a little foolish straight talk too. Don't forget, you can get a dose of foolishness straight to your inbox by going to fool.com.au/MMM. Triple M. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.